This is Jessica Yellen, host of the News Not Noise podcast, former chief White House correspondent for CNN. You can find the News Not Noise letter on Bulletin. I'm so excited to be your guest host again this week. Welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. It's the third week of May, and the country is still reeling from a massacre in Buffalo, New York last weekend, where an 18-year-old white man live-streamed his shooting rampage at a supermarket in a predominantly black neighborhood. He killed 10 people. 11 of the 13 people he shot were black. The shooter, who was not killed by police, is in custody. He wrote a 180-page rant that details his deadly plans and cites the Great Replacement Theory. Authorities call it a hate crime, one of two over the weekend. And this has sparked a national conversation about the threat of domestic terrorism, white supremacy, and more. Let's bring in our left, right, and center panel to try to dissect some of these issues. I am your guest host and your center. I'm joined by Sarah Isger on the right, staff writer at The Dispatch. She was the spokesperson at the Department of Justice under President Trump. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, thanks for having me.
On the left is Baratunde Thurston. He is a founding partner at PUC, who writes about democracy, race, technology, and climate. He is also the creator and host of the podcast How to Citizen. Hi, Baratunde.
What's up, Jessica? Good to be here.
And we're going to bring in our special guest right here at the top. That special guest is Jay Johnson. He was the Secretary of Homeland Security under President Barack Obama. He is now a partner in the litigation department at Paul Weiss. Hello, Mr. Secretary, and I hear you have a new gig as a DJ at the NPR jazz radio station WBGO. Congratulations on the new job.
Thank you very much. That's been like fantasy camp for me.
Great.
I very much enjoy sharing my R&B selections with a terrific public radio audience in the tri-state area around New York.
We look forward to listening to you on the radio. Today, a more serious topic, and before we jump into white supremacy, policy, and politics, I just want to pause and ask everyone for your human reaction. Now that you've had a chance to digest the facts of this shooting for a few days now, what are you thinking, Secretary Johnson?
The events of Buffalo in the last few days are regrettably a tragedy that gets told over and over again. It varies somewhat in its circumstances and its location in the number of victims, but it's a repeated episode of hatred, racial hatred, coupled with the prevalence of guns, the ease of access to guns, assault weapons, which leads to this kind of tragedy. And what is frustrating is that we seem incapable of doing anything about it. And we just, week after week, month after month, see this story play out, see these tragedies play out over and over again. I hope the American public never becomes numb to it.
Baratunde?
We've already become numb to it. After Sandy Hook and the inaction of the slaughter of children, the evidence is in. You asked how we've been feeling. I've been crying a lot in between moments where I have to pull it together to get work done, where I have to check emails and speak on panels and function. I've been taking walks in nature and trying to take deep breaths and not metaphorically or physically actually bang my head against the wall at the repetition of this tragic story that we keep living out in this country, a combination of an unwillingness to face the true history and to properly educate ourselves on where we've been, what we've been through, and how things have gotten the way they are, an inability, unwillingness to teach proper emotional and social skills, especially to our young men who are taught and led by evidence that the proper way to handle such emotion is through weapons of war. It's just a lot. This week has been a lot. This year has been a lot. This millennium has been a lot.
Sarah, your thoughts?
You know, I immediately thought of El Paso, a shooting that happened in my own state just now 3 years ago, where 23 people were killed that day. Interestingly, that shooter citing very similar ideology to this shooter, the FBI, the Department of Justice, and the Department of Homeland Security, for that matter, as the former secretary knows, has been talking about the increasing threat of domestic terrorism. And I think we see how hard it is for our law enforcement agencies to stop lone wolf attacks, as compared, frankly, to international terrorism, where there's more coordination, there's more opportunity and ability for law enforcement to see what's going on. It's incredibly hard to come up with a solution. And yet, at the same time, we're watching it play out again and again. El Paso, now Buffalo. It's very hard to watch.
Yeah, my reaction was sadness, fear, and dread. For so long, so many people have been warning that the mainstreaming of white supremacy is going to drive violence like this. And as this escalates, we still aren't doing anything real about it. And I wonder what it's going to take, how much more of this has to happen before we collectively take real steps to stop this. And if our inability to pass new laws to protect school kids from shootings is a model, proves we really need to try some new strategies. I think we should talk about the shooter's racist motives. Jay Johnson, immediately after the shooting, the FBI investigated this as a hate crime and a racially motivated violent extremism. They even considered terrorism. Now, sometimes with these shootings, there's a debate. You know, we don't know if this was just a crazy man or someone motivated by hate. To me, that often feels like a gaslight. Why do you think in this case it was so quickly pursued as a hate crime? And is that a reflection of a new awareness of this threat to the country?
The reason that law enforcement was so quickly able to label it a hate crime is because the perpetrator's motives and intent and thinking was all over social media. It was right there for everyone to see. Indeed, it was there before he carried out this act of mass murder. And he made plain his hatred. He made plain his intent, his plan, and what he planned to do. So typically in these cases, the assailant winds up dead himself. And how you label the crime depends upon the shooter's motive. And we're often left to speculate about that. But in this case, because of his own rants on social media, on the internet, on various platforms, his intent was plain.
Sarah, your reaction in this case, is this a lone wolf attack or someone motivated by white supremacy? And do you take issue with categorizing this as a hate crime?
So I think it's all of the above. First of all, I think this is obvious that it fits within the definition of a hate crime. His motivations were racial, based on his 180-page manifesto, or whatever you want to call it. What I think, though, has been conflated in the press is the idea that someone like this perpetrator, or many of the others we've seen, and I'm thinking here specifically in the Arizona shooting of Gabby Giffords, for instance, or in the congressional baseball shooting, for that matter, that there's a clear political motive that maps onto our what we understand as our current politics. And I find that frustrating. Someone who believes in a white supremacist ideology, the great replacement theory that they ascribe to, is very different than saying that person supports Republicans, for instance, or Democrats, for that matter. Oftentimes, these lone wolf people have mental illness issues or simply not in touch with reality on the political spectrum the way that we think of it. In this case, right, he hated Fox News. He described himself as a sort of a proto-socialist. I mean, very idiosyncratic political views to go along with his racial bias and motivation. And so I wish we could have a more nuanced conversation before each side of the political spectrum sort of go to their corners and start, you know, pretending like this is just a regular voter who picked up a gun and went to a grocery store. That's not the case here. It doesn't make it better. It doesn't make it less tragic, but I actually think it makes it harder to prevent when we ignore the nuance and reality of the situation. And what motivates these people is not watching Tucker Carlson on Fox News, even though I may not like what Tucker Carlson is saying, or Elise Stefanik's political ad. You might not like that, but if you say that that's what motivated this shooting, I think you're missing how we're actually going to address this problem in the country.
Sarah, let me follow up with you on that. I don't think there's anyone who denies somebody who walks into a grocery store and shoots 13 people has mental health issues. But there is a data set that shows more of these violent extremist acts are coming from people on the far right. That's not a point of view, that's data. And you also have leaders like Elise Stefanik, the third-ranking Republican in the House, who tweeted last year that radical Democrats are planning a permanent insurrection. Here's her tweet. Their plan to grant amnesty to 11 million illegal immigrants will overthrow our current electorate and create a permanent liberal majority in Washington. That sounds a lot like an echo of great replacement theory, which we'll get into. I'm wondering, Sarah, does the Republican Party, in your view, have any obligation to denounce or distance itself from comments like that?
Just to clarify my party, I'm representing conservatives here, but not the Republican Party. That being said, look, again, you look at the shooter in Arizona for Gabby Giffords, you look at this shooter, they do not identify themselves as Republicans. They're very clear. They often hate Republicans. Now, I think you're talking about overall white supremacists tend to identify more with the right side of the political spectrum and perhaps even the Republican Party. I'm not disputing that either. Both of those things can be true at the same time, that these individual shooters consider themselves on the left fringe. Again, that doesn't make them Democrats. And white supremacists can consider themselves more on the right fringe, whether or not they consider themselves Republicans. But you know, when we think about what Elise Stefanik was tweeting, I am I am sympathetic to the argument that now we're just talking semantics and words. So if you talk about the word replacement, then it looks like you're talking about this, again, white supremacist ideology. But when Democrats have talked about demographics as destiny, that in fact, these new voters will replace white voters over time, that's been part of the Democratic, you know, strategy and platform for 20 years. Nobody thinks that's racist. I don't think it's correct, meaning as a matter of politics, as it turns out, Latino voters are far more nuanced and divided and not just lockstep becoming Democrats over the past 20 years, as I think the Democratic Party expected. But unquestionably, the birth rate in the United States is dropping, regardless of your race, by the way. That's a factual statement, very different from what is actually the white supremacist ideology that we call great replacement theory, that they call at least that. That has to do with a conspiracy in which, and again, I'm not an expert on this, but in which Jews are intentionally creating lower birth rates and replacing people. Again, it's a little hard to follow, but that's an actual theory that just happens to share a word, replacing, with something that, again, both parties have talked about, the changing demographics of the United States and how it might help them politically.
There's a lot in there, and let's just ground this first in what is the great replacement theory. The shooter cited it as a motive, and I spoke with Jonathan Greenblatt of the Anti-Defamation League this week for the News Not Noise podcast. He explained the great replacement theory is a conspiracy theory that holds non-white Christian people are replacing white Christian people in Western countries, and it imagines an elite cabal, usually Jews, are organizing to elevate, their theory, black people and also immigrants and refugees to drive out and replace white Christian rule. Now, Greenblatt argues this theory is circulated on social media and repeated and sanitized on Fox News regularly. Baratunde, do you see this popping up in the mainstream?
I do. This murderer and this terrorist painted the N-word on the barrel of his gun, apologized to a white person, and moved on to try to find more black people to kill. He sought to decimate critical infrastructure in a black community in the form of the only grocery store that many people in this part of Buffalo had access to. That's terrorism. This replacement theory is so ironic and infuriating because we've actually seen a replacement practice in this country, the replacement of the indigenous population by the colonizers. And we don't see Native American and indigenous people shooting up white churches and going to Whole Foods to target white people for something that actually happened. You know, this fear of being diluted is so small-minded from a party and a perspective that also pledges to believe in free speech and free markets. Compete for the votes. Believe in yourself. Why is the necessary growth of non-white people a threat to your power? Why are you so small-minded as to not see possible partners for your perspective and a growth for everybody? This is the small, sad story that we keep repeating that's so frustrating. And it is very clear that folks literally in the Republican Party are trying to keep up with a shift in their electorate that they have provoked. They're riding this hate wave to the polls. And they're blaming everybody except underlying true forces for the real problems of this country. It's not Muslims. It's not Mexicans that are leading to inflation. It's not immigrants. It's not Black people that are driving wealth inequality or this scorching of our planet. And so this is all quite a distraction, but it's a playbook that we've run over and over and over again. And it's exhausting. And to have people at the highest levels of one political party in this country embracing it tacitly and sometimes explicitly is disgusting.
Can I follow up on that? Because you mentioned this is, we've seen this over and over, but there is a rise in these incidents now. So why do you think it's getting a special traction at this moment?
I think we live in a country, and when I say I think, I mean I know. I like that you're citing data, so let me cite some data as well. We live in a nation populated more by guns than by people. We are a nation of guns with enough people to reload. We live in a nation that lets a shooter like this blame Black people for showing up to replace white people when we didn't come here voluntarily. We were dragged here. But we're not allowed to teach that in some states because it might make white people uncomfortable. We live in a nation that is threatened by the idea of teaching children to understand their emotions and get in touch with them as a part of some alleged vast left-wing conspiracy. So we channel all that into anger and rage and make guns the obvious choice for too many, especially young men, who are not in touch with themselves and their emotions in a healthy way. So this is all escalating because things are getting tighter. The gun population is growing faster than the human population. We're replacing people, all right, with weapons. So it is a rational outcome to an irrational set of circumstances.
I'll be back with Baratunde Thurston of PUC, Sarah Isgar from The Dispatch, and former Secretary of Homeland Security Jay Johnson to talk about the government's role fighting domestic terrorism. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing civilized yet provocative opinions from across the political spectrum. Now we need to know what you think. Tweet us at LRCKCRW.
Support for Left, Right, and Center comes from Odoo. If you feel like you're wasting time and money with your current business software or just want to know what you could be missing, then you need to join the millions of other users who switched to Odoo. Odoo is the affordable all-in-one management software with a library of fully integrated business applications that help you get more done in less time for a fraction of the price. To learn more, visit odoo.com/LRC. That's odoo.com/LRC. Odoo, modern management made simple.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Jessica Yellen, founder of News Not Noise and former chief White House correspondent for CNN. On the right is Sarah Isgar, staff writer at The Dispatch. On the left, Baratunde Thurston, founding partner at PUC. And our special guest, Jay Johnson. He was the Secretary of Homeland Security under President Barack Obama. Mr. Secretary, you wanted to respond to what Baratunde said.
Yes, you asked about the fact that these incidents seem to be more prevalent, more pronounced. I believe that what is new is that the lid has been peeled off of a lot of hatred in this country. There are those who are racist who feel in the current environment emboldened to bring their hatred out in the open. I think the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville 4 years ago played a large role in that. And I do want to come back to something Sarah said. I agree and disagree with her in part. I disagree in the following sense. I think that those in the more mainstream cable media who command audiences of millions of people have a role and a responsibility here. It's not just a matter of semantics. What we often hear on cable news are more nuanced versions of extremist rhetoric that you see online on the internet. It's not just a matter of semantics, such that someone who is deranged, someone who is prone to violence, will feel emboldened to carry out their acts of violence, to bring out their hate in the open. I agree with Sarah in the following sense. I think we need to avoid making this a debate about politics. A deranged murderer is nowhere on a conventional political spectrum. We have to avoid making this a debate between right and left so that everybody goes to their extreme corners and no one can come together to get stuff done to fix this problem.
Let's talk about some specifics. Tucker Carlson on Fox News frequently alludes to replacement theory, and I just want to play a quick example.
I have less political power because they're importing a brand new electorate. Why should I sit back and take that?
Sarah, as you point out, the shooter mentions Fox in this document, and he seems no friend to Fox, but he's also repeating a theory we seem to be hearing from Tucker Carlson fairly regularly. Do you think Tucker Carlson should be held legally responsible for encouraging beliefs that result in violence?
So, no, and in fact, Governor of New York, Kathy Hochul, said, and I'm quoting her here, "I'll protect the First Amendment any day of the week, but you don't protect hate speech. You don't protect incendiary speech. You're not allowed to scream fire in a crowded theater." Literally everything she just said is incorrect. In fact, the First Amendment does protect hate speech. It does allow you to scream fire in a crowded theater. What it doesn't do is allow you to say something that is likely to cause imminent lawless action. So unless you can show, first of all, there is absolutely nothing to show that this shooter ever watched Tucker Carlson, ever. Again, he said in his manifesto he hated Fox News. He hates the right-wing punditry and right-wing politicians. So there's just absolutely nothing tying him to this. So legally, absolutely not. In fact, it's worth repeating. The First Amendment isn't there to protect speech that we like, speech that we agree with, or else it wouldn't need legal protection. The First Amendment is there to protect the speech that we all find most odious, but that you have the right to say in the United States of America. I don't like what Tucker Carlson was saying, but I will defend legally his right to say something that we don't like. And in terms of his criminal legal liability, again, there's just no evidence to tie this shooter to Tucker Carlson, that he ever even watched Tucker Carlson. So I just find that to be an odd and unhelpful way to even talk about this.
Do you think Fox News in general bears any responsibility? Would you encourage them to change their messaging?
Oh, again, I don't like what Tucker Carlson is saying. I don't like what Fox News says most of the time, much of the time. But I don't like that because of what it has done to our politics and our electorate. And again, I think both sides are just wrong when the Democrats think that demographic changes are going to help them. I think it's wrong when Republicans think that the demographic changes are going to help Democrats only. In fact, we've seen in Florida and Texas, one of the best predictors of which counties voted for Donald Trump in 2020 in Texas was the Latino vote in that county. So again, everyone's theory of demographics has been politically kind of stupid here. I don't like what Fox News has been saying for its political ramifications, not because it led to a mass shooting in Buffalo. Again, there's just no evidence of that yet. I'm open to seeing it, but nobody has shown me it.
One could argue that the evidence is the propensity to see more white supremacist messaging on chat boards, in community rooms, on video game chats, and out in the public at the same time that Fox is starting to mainstream language that you used to only see on far right, as you say, conspiracy theorist websites, not part of a party alignment. If anyone seems to be tying it to the politics of the Republican Party more than any other location, it's the locus of that seems to be Fox News, where on the one hand, they're supporting Republican Party politics, and on the other, using Laura Ingraham's show and Tucker Carlson's show to mainstream some of this language.
I hear you, but in that case, do you blame Bernie Sanders for the shooting at the congressional baseball game? He absolutely was on left-wing chats saying that Republicans were trying to destroy the country, that they had to be stopped, and he took a gun and he shot members of Congress. I don't blame Bernie Sanders for that, and I don't blame MSNBC for it.
Mr. Secretary, this week the House passed a domestic terrorism bill that's meant to beef up government capacity and coordination to fight domestic terrorism, but the votes are not there for it to pass the Senate. Why do you think we lack the political will to tackle this? And can you help us understand what additional tools law enforcement needs?
I think the problem is that this debate, though the tragedy happens over and over again, has become a political debate. When you're talking about violent right-wing white nationalism, people on the right tend to become very defensive and nothing gets done. There are three or four components to this problem that can be solutions. One, frankly, is the prevalence of guns in this country. And I understand an owner's, a responsible gun owner's right to have a gun. I've seen it, say on the Arizona border, for example, a farmer who has a gun to protect his family from drug smugglers. I get that. I respect that. But the ability of a deranged person like this 18-year-old, I won't even utter his name, to get an assault weapon is far too dangerous in this country. There's a role for law enforcement. There's a role for the FBI. There's a role for DHS. We have to hope that they remain focused on this. There are community-based organizations. There's a group in Chicago. They used to be called Life After Hate. I can't remember what they're called now, that actually are dedicated to reforming those who are moving away from violent right-wing extremism. We need to, at the federal level, support those kinds of groups. And then last but not least, and this may be the most difficult thing, those of us who command a microphone have to understand that words have consequences. Words do have consequences. The deranged among us hear validation in a lot of these words, and to a very large extent make violence inevitable. And so this is a problem that takes various different forms. It varies slightly from event to event. The opponents of change always want to point out something in particular about the latest mass murder, about why, you know, gun safety measures would not have helped in that circumstance. But the larger reality is that guns, assault weapons are just far too prevalent in this country, and it is far too easy for a deranged, irresponsible person to get his hands on a weapon of mass destruction.
Sarah, let's talk about gun safety legislation. I covered the White House when the Sandy Hook school shooter killed 26 people, mostly young children. And I was in the briefing room the day President Obama came in tears and vowed to pass legislation to try to stop mass shootings. He upended his agenda to do it and had no success. And there's been really no success since. 85 to 89% of our population supports at the very least increased background checks. And even that can't pass, mostly because of Republican opposition. Why won't Republicans support gun safety measures that have the overwhelming backing of the American people?
Look, as we talk about gun safety in the country, I agree. It seems pretty obvious that the majority of Americans want something done, whether it's limiting high-capacity magazines, whether it's increasing background checks. I think it is a problem that Congress has become so broken when it comes to any legislation. We could fill in immigration, so many other topics that Congress also hasn't been able to act on, despite the fact that the vast majority of Americans disagree on it. I think there's a few reasons for that. I think the executive branch, the judicial branch have taken over traditional legislative functions, allowing Congress to skate by where members of Congress are better off not solving problems, not legislating, because they get hit from the sides, the flanks of both of their parties. Democrats can't compromise on background checks alone, or else they get hit in a primary for not doing more. Republicans get hit for doing too much. And, you know, of course, there's also the question of whether guns are the problem or they are one of many solutions. Look, I agree with the secretary that there is a gun problem in terms, again, high-capacity magazines, background checks, stuff that would be, I think, pretty easy to fix. On the other hand, we have a lot of criminals out there with illegal guns who are doing these shootings. So clearly, gun laws alone aren't going to do it if we're not enforcing them. And two, of course, it's worth mentioning, you know, the person who killed six people at a Christmas parade in Wisconsin, a black supremacist who intentionally targeted white people to kill. He used a car. So the ideology is not attached to guns, and the gun laws alone aren't going to be enough if we can't enforce them. And it means that the rot is somewhere else. I agree that there's a rot, but the gun laws alone aren't going to fix it.
Paratunde, I want to ask you, Axios is reporting that the Department of Homeland Security is bracing for a potential surge in political violence once the Supreme Court hands down the ruling that's expected to greatly restrict or overturn Roe versus Wade. Are you worried that these acts of domestic terrorism will become even more common as we get further into the political season?
Yeah, I am. I am, Jessica. I think we are experiencing rot in a number of places. Gun laws alone won't solve the problem, but no law alone solves any problems. They are a reflection of our values and our priorities and the healthy functioning of our democracy, that when a majority of the people want something, they can use the legislative and other governmental processes to get it. You know, but we don't have that. We have a nation with a really, really extraordinarily high maternal mortality rate, the only one that's growing in the wealthy industrialized world, and we want to force women to give birth. We have 72% of the country, which largely believes that this decision should be, you know, for the person who's pregnant, but we're not doing that. We believe majority in immigration reform. We believe majority in gun safety measures that are reasonable, and we're not getting that. And that's not a bipartisan failure. In most of those cases I just cited, there is a lock on one party, which I cannot emphasize enough, looks the other way at violent insurrection to overturn an election, encourages its operatives to take over election infrastructure, and promise beforehand to guarantee a result regardless of the will of the people. That's one party, that's one ideology that's embracing overturning the will of the people through legal and extra legal means. So when you look the other way at political violence and sometimes even explicitly embrace it, when you guarantee that you're not interested in counting votes, that's a rot too. And we have to address that too. It all leads to a lack of trust in the system. It's something that Putin thrives on. It's something that Viktor Orban thrives on. And you don't see the progressives on the left wing of the Democratic Party gathering in Hungary right now, but you see CPAC doing that. Why are they excited to hang out in a place with no freedom of the press? Why is that the model for that wing of half of our political infrastructure culturally?
A lot of questions and not a lot of clear answers right now. I want to thank Secretary Jay Johnson for joining us, former Secretary of Homeland Security and new music radio host. Can't wait to listen to your show. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
I've been talking with Jay Johnson, Baratunde Thurston, and Sarah Isker. We'll be back with what we learned from this week's primaries. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Thanks for listening to Left, Right, and Center. Is there someone in your life who could benefit from hearing a civilized discussion from all sides? Share the show with them. You can stream all episodes at kcrw.com/LRC, straight from the KCRW app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Jessica Yellen, founder of News Not Noise. On the right is Sarah Isgar from The Dispatch. She was the spokesperson at the Department of Justice under President Trump. On the left, Baratunde Thurston, a writer and founder at PUC. He is also the host of the upcoming PBS series, America Outdoors with Baratunde Thurston. That sounds fun. Let's start with the governor's race in Pennsylvania. We're talking primaries this week. State Senator Doug Mastriano, an election denier Meyer, who worked to overturn Biden's win in Pennsylvania, won the GOP primary. He'll face Democrat Josh Shapiro in November. Now, some liberals are warning that his election to governor would be the death of democracy in the state where the Declaration of Independence was signed. Sarah, I know you're representing conservatives, not the Republican Party. I want to ask you, if he does become governor, in your view, what's the impact on election integrity? And how do you feel about the Republican Party's choice here?
So I find this very frustrating because it's not the first time we've seen it. Back in 2015, Claire McCaskill published a piece in Politico magazine entitled "How I Helped Todd Akin Win So I Could Beat Him Later," in which she talked about putting $1.7 million into ensuring that Todd Akin, who was at that point running in third place in the Missouri Republican primary for the Senate, rocketed him up to first, having him win the primary, where then, we can all remember, in 2012, he talked about, quote, legitimate rape and lost the election to Claire McCaskill. She bragged about that gamble that she took and that it, quote, paid off. Well, this time around in Pennsylvania, something very similar happened. The Democrats put in nearly $1 million, taking Mastriano, very little name ID in the state, who was running against a well-known congressman, Lou Bartoletta, and rocketing him up in the polls. Mastriano himself spent only $370,000 on TV ads. The Shapiro campaign, the Democratic nominee, spent $840,000 on TV ads for Mastriano. They sent out flyers to Republican voters. So look, on the one hand, I find it difficult. Democrats can't say they're worried about our fragile democracy and then help someone win who they think is part of the problem. Either they don't believe that or they're doing something really dangerous, because this is a wave election potentially where Republicans might have an 8-point advantage over Democrats. Mastriano could win the governor's race in Pennsylvania, and Democrats are the ones who put him in the position then to be governor.
Well, let's add a little context around that. Josh Shapiro, who ran for governor as a Democrat, was unopposed. So when you say that Democrats put money into running against Republican opponents, there wasn't a need for money to put against other Democrats. So part of that is the specific context of this election. And I just question whether it makes sense to solely blame Democrats for Republicans electing an election denier as their nominee for this position.
You are exactly right. Republicans picked Mastriano in the end, no question. I think he's a bad candidate who is likely to lose the election to Josh Shapiro. I think it's moved from a toss-up state to a lean Democratic state because he's the nominee. But Democrats who are saying that this is, you know, terrible for democracy and a threat to the Republic, then they shouldn't have put money behind Mastriano.
Baratunde, my whole take is, you know, on the political coverage we live in right now, the political moment we live in, is there's a lot of noise. And when I hear Democrats say things like, this could be the death of democracy if Mastriano is elected, how can you name an election denier to be a possible governor? It sounds like noise, but is this a case in which it's actually a real danger?
Thanks for that, Jessica. And I wanna look more into what Sarah's talking about. It's not entirely surprising if true, because we have incentives to heighten rhetoric from every direction. Again, algorithms of sort of disruption don't just operate in social media, they operate in the money in our politics, IRL as well. But you know, to your earlier point, the Democrats didn't make only 20% of Republicans believe that the 2020 election result was true and accurate and fair. And Democrats haven't funded the overall operation to inspire election deniers to take over election infrastructure in multiple swing states across this country. Republicans and conservatives have done that all on their own. So I do think that the sense of alarm is warranted. I think a lot of our democracy works because we believe it works and because we have implicit trust in the people who operate it. And we have eroded that trust heavily. And in a state like Pennsylvania, where the governor appoints the secretary of state, only one of three states in the union that does that, they have the ability to sow chaos over the apportionment of those 20 electoral college votes. We've also got a country where there's an electoral college whose votes really count in the presidential, not the will of the people. And that, in my view, is a problem. So death of democracy language, I think, is warranted. Is it helpful? Research says maybe not, you know, and language that I try to embrace but don't always is Americans love freedom. We love freedom for our fries. We love freedom for our fashion choices. We love freedom for our guns to a devastating and deadly extreme. And I think all of us believe in the freedom to choose our elected officials and not to have them chosen for us by selectors of an electoral college, by gerrymandering and unfair squiggly lines meant to protect incumbents over new blood coming into the system. So we should be able to find some common ground around the freedom to have the will of the people actually respected by a government by, of, and for the people. And that is increasingly not happening at every level of government.
Sarah, let's stay on Pennsylvania for a moment because two Republican Senate candidates there are neck and neck. They're Trump-backed celebrity Dr. Mehmet Oz and David McCormick. Now, both Oz and his rival, who is a former hedge fund executive, sort of talked Trump's playbook, sought his endorsement. What does it say to you about Trump's power with GOP voters that both candidates, both of these leading candidates, are trying to mold themselves in Trump's image? And how powerful do you think Trump will be in November?
Well, we can add Ohio to that as well, where Trump's endorsed candidate went from arguably third place to first place and won by 10 points in the end. You know, at the same time, I wish we could have all the primaries at once when we answer questions like this, because on the one hand, Trump's endorsed candidate in Ohio wins. Trump's endorsed candidate in Pennsylvania, that's going to go to a recount. Pennsylvania has an automatic recount for a race that's within 0.5%. This race is down right now to 1,200 votes out of 1.3 million. And we haven't seen Georgia, where Trump's endorsed candidate, David Perdue, is actually running potentially double digits behind Brian Kemp. David Perdue has stopped putting up television ads, buying more TV. Outside groups have stopped supporting him. So that campaign seems to be fading away, although, again, we'll have to wait for Election Day. So that's all to say, it's a mixed record for Donald Trump right now, certainly. It's hard to say he doesn't have significant power within the Republican Party, that voters still very much trust his opinion on who should get elected, but that it's not absolute, that Donald Trump's endorsement alone isn't enough to put candidates over the finish line. What does that mean for November? What does that mean for 2024 if Donald Trump chooses to run again? I think it's very clear that Republicans overall still trust Donald Trump quite a bit, and that when they look to 2024, Joe Biden's approval rating right now is in such bad shape that it is giving a lot of room to Donald Trump. Twitter removing Donald Trump, by the way, also I think has allowed voters to sort of forget the day-to-day chaos of what Donald Trump meant. And it's allowed them to sort of have these rose-colored glasses looking back. You know, as one focus group participant said most recently in the New York Times, when Donald Trump was president, gas prices were lower, inflation was non-existent, baby formula was on the shelves. I think that's the problem that we have right now when we talk about Donald Trump's role within the Republican Party.
Baratunde, another vote on Tuesday was for Senate candidates in North Carolina. The Democratic candidate, Sherry Beasley, originally made history as the first Black woman to be Chief Justice of the North Carolina Supreme Court. If elected, she'll be the only Black woman in this U.S. Senate. What does it say to you that at the same time we're having a conversation about the mainstreaming of white supremacy, we're also seeing a state like North Carolina, a swing state that was once conservative, now poised to possibly put a Black woman in the Senate?
I mean, it puts a smile on my face and a bit of a grimace. I'm saddened in some ways that we're in 2022 and we're still celebrating firsts, like first Black woman X. And just the time it's taken to cross some of these barriers is not necessarily a moment of celebration, even as I also acknowledge, like, this is a good thing. I am sure that a lot of credit goes to people on the ground who've been organizing, who've been registering people to vote and making sure those votes are counted by humans, by machines, by a combination of both. And so I just, you know, give a nod to the people at the state and local level who are finding quality candidates, who are bringing new blood into our political system, which both parties desperately need, and who are reminding us that there is more than just terrible, tragic news out there, and that we can generate power even as we are frustrated by the concentration of that power sometimes.
Sarah, in our remaining time, I want to talk about the Republican House race in North Carolina, where Madison Cawthorn, a very controversial candidate, was defeated in his election. Did he go down because of his politics or because he made the cardinal sin of diming out fellow congresspeople who he said might be having orgies and using coke in Washington?
When it comes to Madison Cawthorn, it's really an all of the above strategy. I mean, you know, when you're looking at data, you're trying to single out individual pieces to look for causality and not just correlation. It's impossible with Madison Cawthorn. There were so many scandals. I don't even know what to call them. Weird things. Then you have Tom Tillis, a prominent, well-known Republican in the state, throwing his weight behind Madison Cawthorn's opponent. You also have Madison Cawthorn doing some strange things. There was initially a question over what district he would run in. He said he would just run in his opponent's, another incumbent's district so that he could take out that rhino, a district he hadn't run in before. In the end, he ran in his old district and lost in that one too. But yeah, look, I don't think we can possibly say that it was one thing versus another. His politics, the scandals, the weird pictures, the coke-fueled orgies he talked about, or simply that Republicans at the local and state level in his state implored voters to vote for someone else.
Madison Cawthorn, an unusual candidate. One thing left, right, and center can all agree on. We're going to have to leave it there. We've reached that time once again for our famed Left, Right, and Center rants, featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Sarah Isker, what's your rant?
Oh, my rant is definitely going to be about baby formula. A problem caused by the government that somehow isn't getting fixed by the government. The worst kind of thing that can happen in this country. The FDA shutting down the Abbott plant with no plan for how to replace the large percentage of formula that was being delivered by the Abbott plant to a lot of Americans. And instead, formula shortages started creeping up until in so many states right now, you are not able to get formula for your newborn baby, especially specialty formulas, that has left two children in the hospital. Why did this happen? 17.5% tariff on formulas from overseas, and that the Department of Agriculture accounts for half of all baby formula purchases in the United States through the Special Supplemental Nutrition Program for Women, Infants, and Children, meaning that states sign exclusive contracts with one of four formula makers when Abbott is responsible for two-thirds of all states with those monopolies at the state level. Not surprising that we don't have formula. Deeply surprising that the government is not doing more to fix this problem, though I hope that in the next few weeks, the Biden administration's use of the Defense Production Act will, in fact, make a difference. But too late for so many moms who are stressing out right now.
Baratunde Thurston, what's on your mind?
First of all, I am excited to agree with Sarah. We stand on the same side against monopoly. So I wrote this piece over at Puck.News about Alito's logic in his abortion argument. And one of the pieces that has frustrated me has to do with trust. You know, this country has a history with trust of certain people, but only in certain prescribed circumstances. With Black folk, the people that I'm a part of and descended from in terms of the history of enslavement, we trusted Black people to raise, you know, white children, to build cities that didn't collapse, kids who were safe, but not to, you know, own their own bodies, own their own labor, own their own votes. And I think when it comes to women, we have a similar painful paradox. We trust women to take care of our kids in schools by day, in daycare centers. We trust them to keep us alive in healthcare settings and to manage the family. We trust and expect them to take care of the sick and the elderly without asking, and we saw a lot of them really suffer through COVID disproportionately because of that expectation. Yet, we don't trust women to make decisions about their own health when it comes to pregnancy. And that is a paradox which must end. We've got to go all in and trust people, trust the American people, trust the human beings in our midst. So that fires me up still. The logic of the Alito ruling is nowhere near my rearview mirror at this point. And I thank you for having me here.
Well, we're all talking about women and trust today. My rant is about the sloppy and false claim that this country is divided over whether Roe versus Wade should be upheld. I hear it on cable news. I heard it a ton primary night this week. They say voters are undecided on Roe versus Wade. Untrue. Poll after poll, from Washington Post to the CBS News to NPR, polls show two-thirds of Americans believe Roe versus Wade should be upheld. Only one-third want Roe versus Wade overturned. It is correct to say that Americans are divided over when abortion should be allowed and for whom. Views vary on timing. Americans don't agree on when a fetus is viable. And that should not be shocking given our complicated relationship to science and general lack of awareness about female biology. Anyone in for improved mandatory human biology classes? But Americans are not divided on the question of should Roe versus Wade stand. Americans clearly do not want the government to have the right to flatly ban abortion. And that is not an extremist or far left position. It is the centrist position to support Roe versus Wade. It is where the center of this country, and we do have one, though they are much ignored, stands. That's all we have time for today. Thanks so much to Baratunde Thurston, Sarah Isger, and our guest, Jade Johnson. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Laura Dine Million. Our production assistant is Sarah Singer Schiff. The show was recorded and mixed by Matt Schwartz. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Jessica Yellen. Thanks for joining us. Tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.